Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia to our Zoom meetings, one of our Zoom meetings that we've been doing for over a year now, and they've been working out very well. But tonight we do have a special commemorative day where we will be commemorating it's White Lotus Day, and it's in regards to HPV, and we are looking at not only her life, but her contributions to the philosophy, and we're also looking at this meeting as being a way to infuse the cause of theosophy to revivify our efforts to spread broadcast these ideas. And we're also gathering as a group of like-minded people to which will enhance the spiritual energy to achieve a higher purpose. So why is it called White Lotus Day? The lotus is a sacred symbol in ancient wisdom. It represents the abstract and the concrete, the productive powers of spirit and the physical world. And when we look at these ideas, we can see that they are also a force of ideas when we look at the theosophical philosophy that was presented by HPB. Our meeting will be presented in five sections. The first section, which is going on now, will be a short biographical sketch going over HPB's childhood, her major public life, her duties with the philosophy, and her passing. After the short talk, we will have three readings, which have been chosen by her and mentioned in her will. And they will be from the Bhagavad Gita, the Voice of the Silence, and the Light of Asia. After the readings, we will then have a longer talk regarding HPB's effect on the world and theosophy. We hope that you have come with some of your favorite quotes from HPB, and we will share them after the meeting. Now, what was her purpose? Her purpose was to spread a synthesis of religion, science, and philosophy. As a quote from her, she says that ancient philosophies of Asia offer better solutions to man's problems, individual or collective, than modern Western ones could offer. And she is the first one since the Alexandrian Neoplatonists to put forth this body of teachers and teachings. Now, in regards to a biography of her, from the beginning of her life, from birth, she was anything but normal. She was born premature, was small and frail and sickly, and she was born during a cholera epidemic into a wealthy, noble Russian family in 1831. And she chose to be born in this manner. So one of the problems at that point in time with cholera was that since this epidemic was widespread and she was a frail child, there was a fear that she was going to die soon after she was born. And the family was anxious to have her baptized in case she did not live. And her family was Greek Orthodox Catholic in tradition. And since because of the cholera epidemic, there were not enough people available to partake of the baptismal service. So a small child was chosen to hold one of the candles. But unfortunately, he fell asleep and the priest's gown was set on fire. And many people were burned at that time too. And it's almost like looking back, this seemed to be an auspicious indicator of what her life was to be. And because of this, many of the servants in the Han household felt as though they were very superstitious, and they felt as though she might have some type of powers that they were afraid of. One thing we did forget to mention was, depending on the calendar, if it was Russian or Western, she was either born in the 7th or 8th month of the calendar year on the 30th or the 31st day. And at an early age, she did demonstrate a dual nature. She seemed to have metaphysical powers. She talked about having unseen beings around her and helpers and protectors. And two examples of the protectors are very interesting. One was that apparently as a child, she was riding a horse, and as she's falling off of it, she should have fallen to the ground and probably really hurt herself. But people actually saw that it looked as though something or someone was actually holding her up until they were able to stop the horse from running. And it was also said that she was a very mischievous child, and she liked to read, but at the same time, she liked to play with the servant children, not children of her own class. And one day she was alone in, we guess, the living room or somewhere where there were pictures hanging. And she wanted to, it was crooked and she wanted to straighten it. And she piled tables and chairs and whatnot up into the, so she could get it. And unfortunately she did fall, but again, she was protected. And when the family came in, they noticed that all the furniture had been put back in their normal places. And also, as she got older, she was known to have a very good sense of humor, but at the same time, she also had a rather bad temper. And she apparently did like to party. At the age of 16, she started reading increasingly metaphysical and mystical books. As well as having the bad temper, she was very headstrong and stubborn. A servant told her that if she didn't start acting more like a lady, that she would not ever get married, that she needed to change her frame of mind. On a dare, she was told that she would not even be able to get old Nikifor Blavatsky to marry her. So she took the dare, she took the bet, and she was able to get Nikifor Blavatsky to marry her. So she was at the age of 17 in 1848. But after 3 months, she ran away. And it is said that her father, and she started traveling, and it said that her father did finance her trips. So for the next 20 years, she traveled widely, meeting great teachers, gaining knowledge, and meeting her own master for the first time in 1851 in London. It was there that she was told by her teacher that she would form the Theosophical Society. So there are many, many places where she traveled. So between 1849 until 1873, she traveled to Turkey, Greece, Egypt, France. As we said, in 51 in London, she did meet her master. Then in 52, she came to Canada, the Western Hemisphere, New Orleans, Mexico, South America, the West Indies. Then she came back to India. In 1853, Java and England. She also went 1856 to 1857, Tibet and Burma, Europe and Russia. And on 1868, she went back to India and to Tibet, Greece, Egypt, Lebanon. In 73, she went to Paris and New York. And when she was in New York, that's when she became involved with the spiritualist movement. And then in 1875, she co-starred at the Theosophical Society with Mr. Judge and Colonel Olcott. Her literature is prolific, as we all know. And her first piece of literature in 1877 was Isis Unveiled. She started Theosophy Magazine in 1879. Lucifer, she started in 1887 in London. The Secret Doctrine was written over a long course of time in around 1888. 1889, she wrote The Key to Theosophy and The Voice of the Silence in London. And of course, we know we are grateful to have numerous articles and pamphlets by her. When Mr. Judge and Colonel Olcott and HPB started the Theosophical Society in November of 1875 in New York City, at that point, Mr. Olcott was the president and HPB was the corresponding secretary. In 1878, HPB and Colonel Olcott took the society to India, its new headquarters. And at that point, the society experienced a huge spread of influence at this time. And in regards to Isis Unveiled, it is said that her references and footnotes were amazingly accurate, despite the fact that she did not do any research but was prompted by her teachers. The main objective of her writings was to elevate the mind of the world of the day. Her books were written with the declared object of furnishing the material for intellectual and scientific progress along those lines. It gives to each the possibility of developing the godlike powers within and of at least becoming a co-worker with nature. HBB passed this life on May 8, 1891, at the age of 60. In her will, she requested on the anniversary of her death that friends should gather and rededicate themselves to the cause. So we will now have the three readings that she has requested.
Are you able to unmute?
Is it me?
That's listed as number one.
Who was number one?
The Voice of the Silence.
Oh. I don't know.
I have the reading here. If
go to the second reading.
Of the Silence.
Here we go. Okay, start with the first reading. Thank you.
I beg your pardon.
You can start the first reading.
The Voice of the Silence, Fragment 2, pages 42 through 47, by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. Arhans and sages of the boundless vision are rare, as is the blossom of the Udambaro tree. Arhans are born at midnight hour, together with the sacred plant of nine and seven stalks, the holy flower that opes and blooms in darkness, out of the pure dew and on the frozen bed of snow-capped heights, heights that are trodden by no sinful foot. No Arhan, O Lanu, becomes one in that birth, when for the first the soul begins to long for final liberation. Yet, O thou anxious one, no warrior volunteering fight in the fierce strife between the living and the dead. Not one recruit can ever be refused the right to enter on the path that leads toward the field of battle. For either he shall win or he shall fall. Yea, if he conquers, Nirvana shall be his. Before he cast his shadow off his mortal coil, that pregnant cause of anguish and inimitable pain, in him will men a great and holy Buddha honor. And if he falls, even then he does not fall in vain. The enemies he slew in the last battle will not return to life in the next birth that will be his. But if thy wouldst Nirvana reach or cast the prize away, let not the fruit of action and inaction be thy motive, O thou of dauntless heart. Know that the Bodhisattva, who liberation changes for renunciation, to don the miseries of secret life, is called thrice honored, O thou candidate for woe throughout the cycles. The path is one, disciple, yet in the end, twofold. Marked are its stages by four and seven portals. At one end, bliss immediate, and at the other, bliss deferred. Both are of merit the reward. The choice is thine. The one becomes the two, the open and the secret. The first one leadeth to the goal, the second to self-immolation. When to the permanent is sacrificed the mutable, the prize is thine. The drop returneth whence it came. The open path leads to the changeless change, Nirvana, the glorious state of absoluteness, the bliss past human thought. Thus, the first path is liberation. But path the second is renunciation, and therefore called the path of woe. The secret path leads the Arhan to mental woe unspeakable, woe for the living dead, and helpless pity for the men of karmic sorrow, the fruit of karma sages. Dare not still. For it is written, teach to eschew all causes, the ripple of effect, as the great tidal wave thou shalt let run its course. The open way, no sooner hast thou reached its goal, will lead thee to reject the bodhisattvic body and make thee enter the thrice glorious state of Dharmakaya, which is oblivion of the world and men forever. The secret way leads also to para-nirvanic bliss, but at the close of kappas, without number, nirvana's gained and lost from boundless pity and compassion for the world of deluded mortals. But it is said, the last shall be the greatest. Samyak Sambuddha, the teacher of perfection, gave up his self for the salvation of the world by stopping at the threshold of nirvana, the pure state. Thou hast the knowledge now concerning the two ways. Thy time will come for choice, O thou of eager soul, when thou hast reached the end and passed the seven portals. Thy mind is clear. No more art thou entangled in delusive thoughts, for thou hast learned all. Unveiled stands truth, and looks thee sternly in the face. She says, sweet are the fruits of rest and liberation for the sake of self, but sweeter still the fruits of long and bitter duty. Ah, renunciation for the sake of others, of suffering fellow men. He who becomes Pratyeka Buddha makes his obeisance but to himself. The Bodhisattva who has won the battle, who holds the prize within his palm, yet says in his divine compassion, for others' sake, this great reward I yield, accomplishes the greater renunciation. A savior of the world is he. Behold, the goal of bliss and the long path of woe are at the furthest end. Thou canst choose either, O aspirant to sorrow, throughout the coming cycles. Om Rajapani Om.
Can I have the reading from the Bhagavad Gita?
Yes. Arjuna speaks. What, O Kashyapa, is the description of that wise and devoted man who is fixed in contemplation and confirmed in spiritual knowledge? What may such a sage declare? Where may he dwell? Does he move and act like other men? Krishna responds, a man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge when he forsaketh every desire which entereth into his heart and of himself is happy and content in the self through the self. His mind is undisturbed in adversity. He is happy and contented in prosperity. And he is a stranger to anxiety, fear, and anger. Such a man is called a muni. When in every condition he receives each event, whether favorable or unfavorable, with an equal mind which neither likes nor dislikes, his wisdom is established, and having met good or evil, neither rejoiceth at the one, nor is cast down by the other. He is confirmed in spiritual knowledge when, like the tortoise, he can draw in all his senses and restrain them from their wanted purposes. The hungry man loses sight of every other object but the gratification of his appetite. And when he has become acquainted with the Supreme, he loseth all taste for objects of whatever kind. The tumultuous senses and organs hurry away by force. The heart, even of the wise man who striveth after perfection. Let a man restraining all these remain in devotion at rest in me, his true self. For he who hath his senses and organs in control possesses spiritual knowledge. He who attendeth to the inclinations of the senses, in them hath a concern. From that concern is created passion. And from passion and from anger is produced delusion. From delusion, a loss of memory. From the loss of memory, loss of discrimination. And from loss of discrimination, loss of all. But he who, free from attachment or repulsion for objects, experienceth them through the senses and organs with his heart obedient to his will, attains to tranquility of thought. And this tranquil state attained, therefrom shall soon result a separation from all troubles, and his mind being thus at ease, fixed upon one object, it embraceth wisdom from all sides. The man whose heart and mind are not at rest is without wisdom or the power of contemplation. Who doth not practice reflection hath no calm. And how can a man without calm obtain happiness? The uncontrolled heart, following the dictates of the moving passions, snatcheth away his spiritual knowledge. As the storm, the bark upon the raging sea or ocean. Therefore, O great armed one, he is possessed of spiritual knowledge whose senses are withheld from objects of sense. What is night to those who are unenlightened is as day to his gaze. What seems as day is known to him as night. The night of ignorance, such is the self-governed sage.
Third reading.
On mute.
Okay, thank you. Okay, from the light of Asia. Om Amitaya. Measure not with words the immeasurable, nor sink the stirring of thought into fathomlessness. Who asks doth err, who answers errs, say not. The books teach darkness was at first of all in Brahm, soul meditating in that night. Look not for Brahm and the beginning there. Nor him nor any light shall any gazer see with mortal eyes, or any searcher know by mortal mind. Veil after veil will lift, but there must be veil upon veil behind. Star sweep and question not. This is enough, that life and death enjoy and woe abide, and cause and sequence and the course of time, and being ceaseless tide, which ever-changing runs like a river by ripples flowing, ripples fast or slow. The same, yet not the same, from far off fountain to where its waters flow into the seas. These, streaming to the sun, give the lost wavelets back in cloudy fleece to trickle down the hills and glide again, having no pause or peace. This is enough to know the phantasms are the heavens, earths, worlds, and changes changing them, a mighty whirling wheel of strife and stress, which none can stay or stem. Pray not, the darkness will not brighten. Ask naught from the silence, for it cannot speak. Vex not your mournful minds with pious pains. Ah, brothers, sisters, seek naught from the helpless gods by gift and hymn, nor bribe with blood, nor feed with fruit and cakes. Within yourselves deliverance must be sought. Each man his prison makes. Each hath such lordship as the loftiest ones. Nay, for the powers above, around, below, as with all flesh and whatsoever lives, act maketh joy and woe. What hath been bringeth what shall be, and is worse better, last for first and first for last. The angels in the heavens of gladness reap fruits of a holy past. The devils in the underworlds wear out deeds that were wicked in an age gone by. Nothing endures. Fair virtues waste with time. Foul sins grow purged thereby. Who toiled the slave may come anew a prince, for gentle worthiness and merit won. Who ruled a king may wander earth in rags for things done and undone. Higher than Indra's ye may lift your lot and sink it low, lower than the worm or gnat. The end of many myriad lives is this, the end of myriads that. Only, while turns this wheel invisible, no pause, no peace, no staying place can be. Who mounts will fall, who falls may mount, the spokes go round unceasingly. If ye lay bound upon the wheel of change, and no way were of breaking from the chain, the heart of boundless being is a curse, the soul of things fell pain. Ye are not bound. The soul of things is sweet. The heart of being is ceaseless rest. Stronger than woe is will. That which was good doth pass to better, best. I booed, who wept with all my brother's tears, whose heart was broken by a whole world's woe, laugh, and I'm glad, for there is liberty. Ho, ye who suffer, know ye suffer from yourselves. None else compels, none other holds, that ye live and die and whirl upon the wheel and hug and kiss its spokes of agony, its tire of tears, its nave of nothingness. Behold, I show you truth. lower than hell, higher than heaven, outside the utmost stars, farther than Brahm doth dwell. Before beginning and without an end, as space eternal and as surety sure, is fixed a power divine which moves to good. Only its laws endure.
H.P. Blavatsky and Theosophy. The messenger cannot be considered without considering the message. The two are inseparable. White Lotus Day is the commemoration of the passing of H.P. Blavatsky on May 8, 1891, and her life and work as the messenger who brought theosophy to the attention of the many and to the spiritual needs of the few. The lotus flower is an ancient and universal symbol, but it also is an appropriate symbol of her message and her mission. The lotus seed contains within itself the perfect miniature of the future plant. And it is a reminder, an emblem, that the spiritual model or prototype of all things existing in the material world, of all human beings, exists before those things become materialized on earth. Secondly, it shows to us that man, the human being, and the cosmos share the same elements and are developing in the same direction. The lotus plant grows up through the water, having its roots in the mud, and spreads its flower in the air above. The roots sunk in the mud represent material life, the stalk rising hidden beneath the surface of the water represents the psychic or astral plane of being. And the flower opening up to the sky is representative of our spiritual being. The white aspect of the lotus is good because white is the synthesis or unity of all colors. Can we see the message and the mission in this symbol? For the symbol points to the reality and importance of spiritual being before material existence. That's an important message. It points to the fuller picture of the departments of nature and of the human being. We are more than is visible to the physical eye and senses. That's an important message. As well, it points to the evolutionary growth, the common evolutionary growth, the process. An important message that we evolve physically, psychically, or mentally, if you will, and spiritually. And of course, the white being the synthesis points to the underlying unity and identity of all human beings. Her object, we might say, was threefold. First, it was to provide an outline and fundamental principles of the ancient wisdom religion, a body of ancient knowledge. Second, it was to lay down lines that pointed to a spiritual path of progress that excluded no one or left no being out. That one should not and cannot evolve without raising up or raising all of nature. And that potential is possible for all beings. That's an important object. And thirdly, to found and establish the nucleus, or a nucleus, a universal brotherhood from which would radiate in all directions powerful influences to promote the elevation of the mind and heart of the human race to the reality and practice of unity, her most important object. In her own words, we have this address to the American Theosophist, her fourth address, in 1891, only a few weeks before her death. She says to us, "Be Theosophists, work for Theosophy, Theosophy first, and Theosophy last, for its practical realization alone can save the Western world from that selfish and unbrotherly feeling that now divides race from race, one nation from the others, and from that hatred of class and social considerations. Theosophy alone can save it from sinking entirely into that mere luxurious materialism in which it will decay and putrefy as civilizations have done. In your hands, brothers, is placed in trust the welfare of the coming century. And great as is the trust, so great is also the responsibility. My own span of life may not be long. And if any of you have learned aught from my teachings or have gained by my help a glimpse of the true light, I ask you in return to strengthen the cause by the triumph of which that true light made still brighter and glorious through your individual and collective efforts will lighten the world, and thus to let me see, before I depart with this worn out body, the stability of the society secured." The theosophy she referred to is that boundless and timeless ocean of spiritual truth and knowledge that accommodates and nourishes all beings. And every sincere creed and philosophy, it clashes with none. The custodians of that truth, down through the ages, she referred to as Mahatmas, and that they were her teachers. The society that she referred to was the Theosophical Society. She co-founded that society with William Q. Judge and Henry Steele Olcott in 1875 under the direction and inspiration of her teachers. Here's what one of the Mahatmas wrote. "The only object to be striven for is the amelioration of the condition of man by the spread of truth suited to the various stages of his development and that of the country he inhabits and belongs to. Truth does not suffer from the name under which it is promulgated if the said object is obtained." So that society she founded had three original objects, which we have from her in The Key to Theosophy. First, to form the nucleus of a universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, or color. Two, to promote the study of the world's philosophies, especially the old Asiatic ones, and religions and sciences. And three, to investigate the hidden mysteries of nature under every aspect possible, and the psychic and spiritual powers latent in the human being, especially. In one sense, her mission was nothing new, unique or original. And she said so. We have these words in the secret doctrine. But to the public in general and the readers of the secret doctrine, I may repeat what I have stated all along, and which I now clothe in the words of Montaigne. Gentlemen, I have here made only a nosegay of culled flowers, and have brought nothing of my own but that string that ties them. In another sense, she was unique, of her own kind, in a class by herself, sui generis, she used to say. In her introduction to the secret doctrine, she refers to this universally diffused wisdom religion of the ancient and prehistoric world, and that its teachings were preserved by the Lodge of Adepts. True, the documents were concealed in secret libraries, but knowledge of its existence was never made secret. It was referred to by the Egyptian hierophants, by the Babylonian mages, Pythagoras, Plato, and even Jesus. And yet, after ages of secrecy and silence, a few doctrines were released from this profound silence and secrecy, especially those dealing with the origin and evolution of the cosmos and humanity. An outline of its fundamental truths were given out. And she tells us why, after all those centuries, it was given out now. She says in the secret doctrine in her introduction, "The world today, in its mad career towards the unknown, is rapidly progressing on the reverse material plane of spirituality. It has now become a vast arena wherein lie buried the highest and most holy aspirations of our spiritual soul. Her mission as an agent of the Lodge of Adepts was unique to the times, tendencies, and temperament of our age. An agent for communication of knowledge, any kind of knowledge, must be fit and must be able to conform itself to the surrounding circumstances. It was not her physical health or her education that made her fit. Rather, it was the qualities we all have and can emulate, develop. It was her extraordinary charity, honesty, courage, endurance, energy, indifference to the criticism of others, exquisite mental faculties, and especially her psychic abilities and spiritual qualities of devotion and faith in the teachers and the teachings. Like a long line of teachers and sages and agents of the lodge before her, she gave out those pearls of spiritual truth suitable to the needs of the nation, race, and civilization of our time. But all that in the past, we see evidences of this same activity, whether we're referring to the mystery schools, the esoteric message and aspect of exoteric religions, the teachings of Pythagoras and the Neo-Pythagoreans, the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven referred to by Jesus, Buddha's teachings to his arhats, and the Gnostic, Sufi, Hermetic, and Kabbalistic lines that stretched into the Middle Ages and Renaissance, all point to these common spiritual truths, the property of humanity. And yet, like the long line of reformers before her, she had to be prepared to defend timeless and universal truth in the very face of ignorance, superstition, prejudice, and dogmatism, common human frailties that always are the obstacles to the acquirement of wisdom. And even the devotee has to face and conquer these same human flaws within their nature, that spiritual progress may be achieved. It's clear from her very first pages, the Isis unveiled, she knew what would come. She expected opposition from the orthodoxy and dogmatism of religions, organized religions. She expected and was prepared for skepticism, ridicule, and scorn from materialistic science and scientists. And she expected prejudice from those authorities whose pet theories were challenged by the whole truth. Her mission, though, and we need to keep this in mind, had its unique aspect compared to the previous efforts of the Lodge. And we want to keep these things in mind when thinking of HPB. Her mission was to humanity itself and for the purpose of elevating humanity rather than to a particular nation or race. The culmination of her recording of the ancient religion in the Secret Doctrine, the subtitle being, this was a synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy. And third, she presented a portion of the ancient wisdom religion in print that had never been disclosed publicly before. So she was very similar to predecessors, but in a sense, her mission was unique and unprecedented in our time or even in the past. So important is that we would like to spend a little bit of time going into these aspects a little deeper. Her mission was for humanity and the human race in general. According to the teachings of theosophy on the esoteric history of humanity, thinking human beings have been on this planet for 18 million years. At that time, these ideas were taught to humanity by wise beings who had acquired this knowledge in previous periods of evolution. These ideas were impacted in the very spiritual center of human nature, as well as being preserved orally in written form for ages, unbroken by a long line of adepts. Perfected human beings who had developed their psychic, mental, spiritual, and physical capacities to the highest possible degree on Earth. So it is impacted there, and preserved there in our nature. Therefore, theosophy is the birthright of humanity, even if humanity is unaware of that spiritual aspect. And that spiritual knowledge is clouded over now by our excessive intellectuality, materialism, and selfishness. And we know it's for humanity because she says in her dedication to the Secret Doctrine, this work I dedicate to all true theosophists in every country and every race, for they called it forth, and for them it was recorded. Well, who or what is a theosophist? A theosophist, she tells us, is an original thinker, a seeker after eternal truth, with an inspiration of his own to solve the universal problem. And such an individual puts into practice the loftiest moral ideal and strives to realize his unity with the whole of humanity and works ceaselessly for others. Clearly, a theosophist can belong to any religion, creed, nation, or race. The message of theosophy is not bound by boundaries or language or any other things that limit the reception of a message. Second, It's distinguished her mission in that she gave a synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy. And we know we've had great moral reformers in the past. We've had great philosophers in the past. But this was different. This was an age of science. And she was prepared to present that theosophy is a religious science and a scientific religion. It accepts nothing on blind belief, as religions may demand. But it checks, tests, and verifies the operation of the law in all departments of nature, as science should. Spiritual, mental, psychic, and physical. Philosophically, its main point is that all has emerged from one source. Scientifically, its main point is that the universe and man is worked and guided from within outward. This is a universal law. And religious or ethically, its main point is that it unites all beings into one harmonious whole, universal brotherhood being a fact in nature and the foundation of ethics. So ethics are not mere sentiments. They are reflections of the law of harmony and interdependence. So it challenged the so-called miracles of religion, and it also challenged the purely materialistic doctrines of science. And thirdly, she placed before the public a portion of the ancient wisdom religion, which she says is not a speculation, nor is it the property of any nation, but it is the accumulated wisdom of the ages. Facts had to be gathered by countless generations of adepts, checked, tested, and verified and confirmed by great periods of time. And we do not have it all, but we do have a small portion of that knowledge. The truths that we need today, the truths that are suitable to our present state of psychic, mental, and spiritual development. Considering the uniqueness of this mission and its unprecedented in anything in recorded history, what must have been the nature of the being who was able to present it, who was tasked with the responsibility to put it forth in such a short period of time, under the most difficult of circumstances. So we return to our symbol of the White Lotus. And we see in it the threefold aspect of theosophy, a threefold aspect of HPB and her mission. Theosophy, in one sense, is what is recorded in her writings, what is visible to all, which anyone can go to in any library on the internet now, anyone can read, and that's visible to all. And it corresponds, in a sense, to HPB, the historical personage, who anybody can read about. We've had a presentation of her life. We know there's records, there's eyewitnesses to her existence. And it's also corresponds to the Theosophical Society that she founded, all the physical body of which there are centers all over the world, even today. This is all symbolized by that lotus, the aspect of the lotus, the roots that are sunk in the mud being material existence. So that part of the root lotus represents the physical aspects of HPB, the physical aspects of the movement, the physical aspects of her mission. But what about that part of the lotus that grows up like the stalk through the water, invisible? This is theosophy, the accumulated wisdom of the ages, including knowledge of all the inner departments of nature. All the inner departments of nature, just like those hidden aspects of the lotus that are hidden between the water, that we only get glimpses of, not the full picture. it corresponds to the inner aspect of HPB that was not observable by her personality. And we all know that we wear a mask of personality, but who can see our inner nature, even our thought, our thinking? So that refers to HPB, the incarnated mind being working through the body and for the mind and heart of the race at the time and for us today. It also represents theosophy, or the theosophical nucleus of universal brotherhood, not any particular association localized in a certain town, but the collective work of all theosophists around the world, united by one aim and purpose and teaching. Aim and purpose, all inner aspects of our unity, not outer aspects. And the lotus also represents that theosophical, we said that theosophical nucleus of universal brotherhood. Well, how about the aspect of the lotus that opens up into the air, the spiritual being? Well, that's theosophy, divine spiritual knowledge. It's not the theosophy that you can find in the book. It's not the theosophy recorded in ancient glyphs and symbols, imperishable. It's rather that the theosophy that's impacted in the very center of our spiritual being, theosophy that is one with universal mind, that can only, divine truth, that can only be reached through the use of the higher mind, that is only the fruit of individual effort to reach up and to master it. It also corresponds to HPB, not the personality, not the mind being, but that great being, that great spiritual being who came among humanity and accomplished in a few short years what had never been done before. It also represents that brotherhood of adepts, or the great spiritual being who was part of that brotherhood of adepts through the ages. In a sense, that lotus, and we'll finish with this thought, that lotus blooming into the spiritual realm is not the theosophy of the Theosophical Society that you can find in the cities. It's not even the theosophical movement that's the collectivity of all individuals working, but rather it is the theosophical movement of ideas through the ages, wherever thought has struggled to be free. And so White Lotus Day, a wonderful symbol, remind us of the HPB, theosophy, our message. And it's important to have symbols that we can carry around in our mind, because it keeps us focused, keeps us aware of our aim and purpose and the important truths that guide us. So we'd like to stop here and invite you to put up your pictures if you wish, and open up your mics and begin to share with one another any favorite quotes that made a difference in your life and still do make a difference. And DW, would you like to begin?
Yes. There's a quote in the Secret Doctrine. It reads as follows: every form on earth and every speck atom in space strives in its efforts towards self-formation to follow the model passed for it in the heavenly man. In the atom's involution and evolution, its external and internal growth and development have all one and the same object, man. Man as the highest physical and ultimate form on this earth, the monad, in its absolute totality and awakened condition, as the culmination of the divine incarnations on earth.
MJW?
This is from Isis. Night rests humanity from the day of activity and restores the equilibrium of human as well as of cosmic nature.
JCS?
This is from the first message that she gave in 1888. Theosophy seeks to develop the human nature in man in addition to the animal. And at the sacrifice of the superfluous animality which modern life and materialistic teachings have developed to a degree which is abnormal for the human being at this stage of his progress. Men cannot all be occultists, but they can all be theosophists. Many who have never heard of the society are theosophists without knowing it themselves. For the essence of theosophy is the perfect harmonizing of the divine with the human in man, the adjustment of his godlike qualities and aspirations, and their sway over the terrestrial or animal passions in him. Kindness, absence of every ill feeling or selfishness, charity, goodwill to all beings, and perfect justice to others as to oneself are its chief features. He who teaches theosophy preaches the gospel of goodwill. And the converse of this is true also. He who preaches the gospel of goodwill teaches theosophy.
TK?
Well, we can't actually recall where we pulled it from, which book, because we have it in our notes. So, night before last, I was shown a bird's eye view of the Theosophical Societies. I saw a few earnest, reliable theosophists in a death struggle with the world in general and with other nominal and ambitious theosophists. The former are greater in number than you may think, and they prevailed, as you in America will prevail, if you only remain staunch to the master's program and true to yourselves.
Thank you. MHW.
This is from her fourth message as well. If every fellow in the society were content to be an impersonal force for good, careless of praise or blame, so long as he's subserved the purposes of the brotherhood, the progress made would astonish the world and place the arc of the TS out of danger. Take for your motto and conduct during the coming year, peace with all who love truth in sincerity. And the convention of 1892 will bear eloquent witness to the strength that is born of unity.
Yes, Julius.
This is from one of the written works of H.P. I forgot which one, but it reads, the universe is worked and guided from within outward.
Any other? Yes, I'm JW.
Yeah, we think this goes along with the last one. This is from Isis. Harmony in the physical and mathematical world of sense is justice and the spiritual one. Justice produces harmony, and injustice, discord. And discord on a cosmical scale means chaos, annihilation. If I may do another, the self of matter and the self of spirit can never meet. One of the twain must disappear. There is no place for both. From the voice of the silence.
JCS.
This is in the first volume of The Secret Doctrine. Page 604. From gods to men, from worlds to atoms, from a star to a rushlight, from the sun to the vital heat of the meanest organic being, the world of form and existence is an immense chain whose links are all connected. The law of analogy is the first key to the world problem. And these links have to be studied coordinately in their occult relations to each other. A perfect statement of universal brotherhood.
MDW. Unmute.
From the voice of the silence. Thou hast to study the voidness of the seeming full, the fullness of the seeming void.
Thank you. We have time for one or two more. Well, we just think that if we have favorite quotations, it must mean that it satisfies a need within each of our nature. And as varied were the quotations, so varied are the needs of each individual. And yet we can all listen to them and find, aha, yeah, that is useful. So there is a part of our nature which responds to universal truth, and we all do. And then there's part of our nature which is just right for us where we are. May not mean the same for somebody else. And it doesn't really matter because it's all impacted in our nature. And as HPB said in the introduction, in their dedication, for you, it was recorded because you called it forth. So now that you called it forth, what are you going to do with it? And with that note, we thank you for participating in our yearly commemoration of White Lotus Day. And we will continue our regularly scheduled meetings this Friday and Sunday and next Wednesday, picking up once again with the Ocean of Theosophy. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night, all.
Good night.